Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Awakened Life, Talk Radio Evolved. We're here, as usual, to talk about waking up and showing up. That means waking up to who we are and creating heaven on earth through our pure and lived expression of that truth. And our guest today is someone who's helping people to do that in a big way. He's a Rinzai Zen master. He's the creator of the Hollow Bones lineage. And he's the subject of a recent book that's coming out called The Heart Blown Open. We're really honored to have him on the show. Jumpo, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's always great to check in with like hearts, like minds.
Well, that's an honor coming from you. We've been talking about you a bit on the show, and we just really respect the work that you're doing, and just wanted to, really give our listeners a view into Mondo Zen and how specifically, it can help them both awaken to who they are and also integrate that into their lives. And it's from what I can tell by the work that from my view of the work, that's really what Mondo Zen is about.
Yes. And you said waking up and growing up.
Yes.
Right. And this, we use this in integral speak with the Wilbur's philosophical gang.
Yeah.
Waking up and growing up. And what Mondo Zen is, waking up, growing up, and showing up. And so we've got a system where you wake up, grow up, and then evaluate whether or not you're showing up.
Right.
So it's a classic system, Zen system, koan system, upgraded for the 21st century. Postmodern application and understanding.
So how did you become Jumpo, just to give maybe the listeners some background on how you got to this point doing what you're doing?
Just a lot of bad luck. I never intended to become a certified Zen master. But what happened was, oh gosh, this gets a little into my history, but during the 1960s and early 70s, I was deeply involved in the counterculture. I was an urban shaman and the head of the windowpane clear light LSD family. And so after 10 years being underground, and a lot of psychedelic research in religious context and setting, and also some really wonderful partying, but my inquiry was always, what's the deeper truth? What's consciousness? Is there a soul? Is there life after death? All these wonderfully boring questions.
Easy questions.
I really pursued that path, and then completed that path, and started teaching, and I pursued the path of Buddhism and yoga, the Tibetan tradition for a little while. I started with Zen, went to Trungpa. I started with Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco in 1967, I guess it was 68.
Yep. Author of Zen, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Right. And then floated over to in the early 70s to with Chogyam Trungpa and the Karmapa, and practiced Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhism for about a year and a year and a half, and found it to be way too baroque for my taste, and went back to my Zen roots.
Mm-hmm.
And then discovered the vehicle of Ashtanga Yoga and studied with BKS Iyengar. I took my teacher training in San Francisco in the early 80s. And then traveled to India a couple of times, studied with Batabi, and thought I was pretty cool, and opened my own Zen Yoga Center. I got ordained in a Japanese tradition. And my teacher knew I was a wild man, so he said I didn't have to do... My insight was deep enough, and he trusted me as long as I returned regularly. So I went on and opened my own center. This was a monk out in California for 4 years.
Mm.
Then I had a little ethical moment of confusion, and it really struck me deeply that something was missing in concentration path, my yogi path, my Buddhist path, that I wasn't as awake as I needed to be. And what and how and why could that be? So I went back to the monastery and asked my abbot, I said, am I trainable? And he said, Jumbo, I think you're worth civilizing. cut a deal, so I'd go back to the monastery. He said, "Will you come to monastery?" I said, "No, I haven't been to college. I want to go to New York University, and I'll be your ingi. I'll be your attendant. Whenever you're doing something, I'm going to be standing at your side. I'll sit every retreat you lead, you know, but I want to go to school. I want to get education now." Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was 1987. I was already 45 years old. So the so he said, "Well, what would make you go back to the monastery?" And so I said, "Well, nothing. I had been to federal prison for a year because of conspiracy charges. We're never charged with doing anything other than talking about it, but that was enough." Mm-hmm. And so I went to jail for a year. So I said, "I've been institutionalized. I've trained in monasteries, and I don't like those places. Mm-hmm. I don't like prison." And I said, "If I had to choose between a good federal prison and a monastery, I'd probably take the prison." Because you have to face yourself a lot more directly there. Most people don't, but I mean, if you don't want to use the time, doing time is, whether you're in a monastery or prison, it really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But that's another argument, a long story.
Sure.
So what happened was, he said, "Well, what would make you go?" So I said, "Well, are you serious?" He said, "Go be head monk. I want you to run the place." And I said,
"Oh, wow."
Well, said, "Well, are you serious?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, a yoga program, because the bodies really need the yoga, mm-hmm. an organic kitchen, and a psych department, because half the people you got up there are crazy. Right? They need therapy." You know? Sure. So I said, if I could do that and start an outreach program to bring people in and interact with the community, I said, I'd do that." He said, "What, Jumbo, would I have to do any of that?" I said, "No," he said, "okay, you've got a deal." And yeah, he had my back for 7 years. Yeah.
And so was that the beginning then of Hollow Bones?
No, the Hollow Bones, what happened in 1993 is I realized that the ethnocentric Japanese enculturation of the Dhyana Zen tradition, the Buddhist tradition, the Zen tradition, is the classic path of yoga's, and meditation in the Buddhist tradition or the yogic tradition is concentration, dharana, mm-hmm. Meditative awareness, or the mind in which the concentration is taking place, the realization of that, that's called dhyana, and then samadhi, or the unreasonable enjoyment that follows the insight and the shift. But and how the Japanese say the word chan is zen. So zena, it was chana, and chana is how the Chinese say dhyana. So it's the Dhyana lineage, it's mm-hmm. meditative lineage and practice.
So are there Zen traditionalists that give you a hard time?
Yeah. You know, their question is, they say, "You're doing therapy," right? And I go, "Yeah."
Duh.
Zen isn't therapy. And I said, "Well, maybe it should be." Yeah. Like I tell them, I said, there's only one thing wrong with therapy as it's run today, and as Zen as it's conducted today. And I said, "Well, what's that?" I said, "They don't work." Right?
But together, you might have
together,
a powerful...
You yeah. stand a real great chance. So, I mean, it's black humor. Of course Zen works. Of course therapy works. Mm-hmm. But not in a broad way. I've been doing therapy 12 years. Mm. You've been doing therapy 12 years? Who have you been? What kind of therapy have you been doing for 12 years?
Sure.
You're paying for somebody to listen to you.
You've been doing Zen for how many years? 30 years?
And, exactly.
Right? So,
and still, yes. I suffer from cranial rectal inversion. You know, 30 years at the wall. No, back to the Zendo is not the answer to philosophical confusion and emotional immaturity.
Sure.
You need to be deconstructed and reconstructed philosophically or neurolinguistically. Mm-hmm. And then you need to transform your understanding relationships to your emotional body. And those are the things that Mondo does. We still do the meditation. Like, if you come to our retreats, we do about 4.5 hours of meditation, concentration, meditation, awareness, koan work. We do 4 hours of philosophical and emotional koan interaction work. We do 2 hours of Qigong or yoga. And so that's just a regular day.
And is that that picture, is that a full picture of Mondo Zen, that activity?
That activity would be a training day at a Mondo Zen retreat.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And, yeah. But it begins, well, so back to what happened. So I went to the monastery, and where the name Junpo came from was Eda Roshi gave me the name early on in 81. And Junpo means Dharma that goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So Dharma teaching that travels everywhere. So that was a funny little story. So we're standing out on the deck above the shrubbery in the beautiful monastery, Daibosatsu Kangoji Monastery in Livingston Manor in New York, 2.5 hours up in the Catskills. If you ever get a chance to go there, it's the most beautiful monastery in the West.
Mm-hmm.
28,000 square feet.
Oh, my. Wow.
2-mile private road, 1,600 acres hard rock maple. Oh, a private 6-7 acre lake with the old Victorian where Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Oh, my. Wow.
On the property. It's an exquisite place. Eda Roshi's retired now, and one of his Dharma heirs, a woman, is running the place. But so we're standing on the deck, and he gave me the name, and I said, okay, Junpo. And I said, what does it mean? He said, Dharma Cruiser. And I said, Dharma Cruiser? I said, oh, you like a medium-weight battleship? You know, I said, I like that. They protect the fleet. No cruisers. There's no fleet that can survive without cruisers. Battleships are too slow and big targets. The destroyers are too little and light. Cruisers, that's it. He goes, no, Junpo, not a battleship. I said, well, like what? What then? He said, more like a Toyota.
Oh, God. These stories are great. These are really good. And are these some of the stories that are highlighted in your new book, too, A Heart Blown Open?
Yeah, that's a friend of mine and a student of mine,
yeah,
and a teacher of mine, Keith Martin Smith. He's an exquisitely brilliant martial artist and writer. And he and I hung out and I just told him a bunch of stories, and he wrote them down. He's a good writer.
Yeah, these are some good stories.
Some of these might be in the book, but yeah. The book was 150 pages too long, so they edited the hell out of it. Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't read it since its final edit. But yeah. these are the kinds of stories, but also the stories of the psychedelic experiences and things, and then you know the things from my torrid past, and then things from my reformed life. So it's just a
well, and all things I certainly want to hear more about. So we're going to go to our first break. We're talking to Junpo Dennis Kelly Roshi today, creator of Mondo Zen. We'll be back in just a minute. We're going to learn more about what is Mondo Zen, really. You're listening to Awaken Life here on KKNW. Hello, everyone. This is Adam Seward, host of Awaken Life. I'd like to personally invite you to our monthly silent meditation gathering. Space will be held at Unity of Bellevue for those who wish to gather and practice meditative silence. More info can be found at www.adamseward.com. I hope to see you there.
Are you upside down on your home loan and facing foreclosure? Washington's Foreclosure Fairness Act takes effect on July 13th and requires your mortgage holder to grant you a face-to-face meeting to negotiate modifications to your loan that may let you keep your house. More than 5,600 homes were seized in the first 3 months of this year in the state of Washington. Don't let this happen to you. Visit foreclosurefairness.net. That's foreclosurefairness.net or call 206-818-9732, your home safety net.
Called the Oprah of radio by her listeners, award-winning host Dr. Pat Basile is blowing the doors off traditional talk radio. Get ready for powerful interviews with leaders in the field of human potential. Dr. Pat's perspective on living life full out has catapulted her show to the top of talk radio. Tune in, and Dr. Pat will help you thrive instead of merely survive. Listen to the Dr. Pat Show Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to noon on AM 1150, KKNW, and visit thedrpatshow.com.
Hi, this is Adam Seward.
And I'm Rick Seward.
And together we have partnered to bring you Awakened Life as part of our commitment to supporting the unfolding of human and planetary consciousness. That's also why we decided to create the Awakening Foundation. Well, what's the Awakening Foundation? The Awakening Foundation is a nonprofit organization that's designed to help facilitate the evolution of consciousness through the creation and distribution of what we're calling Awaken Media. We'd love to connect with you. For more information on the Awakening Foundation, go to adamseward.com. If you'd like to find out more or to talk with us about how you can support the mission, fill out the contact form and we'll get back to you right away. Thanks for listening to Awaken Life. We look forward to connecting with you. Hello, world. Welcome back to Awaken Life. If you want to listen to this broadcast at a later time, you can always go to adamseward.com and download from our archive there. That's adamseward.com. So today we're talking to Renzai master and huge teacher in my world, Jumpo Dennis Kelly Roshi. And before we went to break, we were outlining some of this awakened technology that he's created, which he calls Mondo Zen. Jumpo, could you tell us a little bit about what is Mondo Zen?
So, Mondo is a word for the old dialectic dialogue, for the koan conversation between a teacher and a student. And many times it was between a fully realized and mature student and a teacher, and sometimes it was between just a beginning student and a teacher. So the Mondo has historical record going back to Tang Dynasty China. So Mondo is what it is. It's a public dialogue. And what we do is we gather, and we will do it individually or we do it collectively, where we sit down and begin this dialogue. And we use the koan system. The koan system has, in five or six divisions, this system I come out of, I work with the basic five divisions or koans. And a koan is a question, which is a concentration practice. It's at the front end of your meditation insight practice. The mind, you want to gather and bring to one point. And so to bring and gather the mind to a point, it's really good to have something to do. And you could follow any mental activity. You could follow any skanda, any activity of the mind. You could use smell, taste, touch, and or even a thought or a feeling. But so whatever's arising in the mind, do it, repeat it again and again and again and again, and you will deepen your insight into the true nature of your mind rather than what's going on in the activity in the mind. So in the classic koan system, the first koans are insight koans. Where is the Buddha? What was your original face before your mother was born? Those are really simple questions if you understand the question. So we explain the question. The question is, what is your mind before your conceptual self creates the entity of an ego? And so the system begins with questions that say, okay, use that concentration. Where is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? Where? Who? Right? And so you're concentrating. So we begin with concentration practices. And once your concentration is deep enough and you come to a degree of realization, you will shut up. The question falls away. And the only way to answer the question, to answer that koan, is to present the mind of Bud. And Bud just is awake. Bud is not some special character. Buddha is awake person, awake being. So the Bud in you, when you awaken to the Bud in you, you are completely silent, completely present, and completely awake. Great. Now you've had a degree of insight into the true, pure nature of your consciousness. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now the second koan comes in, spontaneity. Now make some movement from there. Make some movement, but don't use language yet. So express yourself, but express your realization through embodiment with a gesture of some kind. And then say, okay, now that you've got those two together, now we'll go, we have poetic license. Let's use some language. But don't give me a whole lot of language. Just give me some insightful little slogan, some haiku or a little line of poetry that represents your realization. And then we have difficult to pass. So then the koans become elaborate with a lot of language to try to confuse you and trick you and take you back into your ego referencing. And then, finally, we get to precept koan, behavior koans. So that's what you would do classically if you were going through the koan tradition. There are 1,700 koans. Itaroshi and I, we worked together in the early 80s and picked, or mid 80s, and picked 108 for the monastery that we were using back then. And so what happened is my experience of people that had done the koan process and people that had done, you know, and that weren't still awake had developed some degree of state stability. But they still hadn't awakened to the depth of compassion that would then drive their life in a particular way, where their behavior would represent the embodiment of compassion. For instance, on a long retreat one time in the 70s, I was not a long retreat, a seven-day retreat at a Zen, particular Zen center in California. The woman that was directing the work practice for the day met some kids who wanted to cut across the property. And she wouldn't allow them. She said they had to pay a day fee to get across the property to get to a swimming hole. And I couldn't believe that she did that, and she enjoyed it. She said, no, you guys will have to walk. It was like a two-mile hike around the place to get there. And I told her, I said, what? I said, these kids are tired and hot. Let them cut across the property. She said, rules are rules, right? Mm-hmm. And I went, wow, she's been sitting for 20 years. So I paid, so I just paid, said, okay, now they can walk across the property. And she got really angry with me. And, you know, and it really twisted my head up. I went, how can that be? How can that be? How can that be? How can that be? So the concentration practice is in the fact that she could enter into state and have a nice place to hide and hang out didn't mean that she had could embody compassion. Mm-hmm. And Zen is a marriage of wisdom, purity of mind, clarity of mind or pure consciousness, and compassionate action or activity. So wisdom and compassion combined are Zen.
Right. And this is the essence of waking up and showing up as well, isn't it?
Right. And waking up and showing up. And then, like I said, what we do with the mandu is we say, okay, now show me where you're growing up. So we created koans. So the first koans are, first koan that we use in the process, in the inquiry, is the question, is it possible for you to purely listen? Is there pure listening within you? So there's superficial listening, we say. But is there a depth of listening within you that's pure, that has no reactivity or no opinion?
Mm-hmm.
Is that depth within you? So the koan injunction is simply listen. 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 On every in-breath and every out-breath, tell yourself to listen. Repeat. So you have this arrow pointing at the listening, right? So you use that concentration practice. And so we begin with that koan, which is the beginning of the insight. And then we say, okay, now, is it possible for you to purely listen? And so then when someone has the experience of pure listening, or at least philosophically says yes, and if we use beautiful Japanese bells, use any bell for the listening. So you strike the bell and follow the sound within. And one little exercise we do is keep the sound out. If you think there's no pure listening within you, see if you can keep the sound out of a deeper listening. And then notice how the mind struggles and get the sense of the superficiality of the reflective ego. So I'm moving ahead. I'm sorry, I'm into the koan process already. But
well,
when you...
one question that came up for me a little bit earlier was, I'd love to hear an example of someone failing a koan and someone passing a koan that you've had. Because I've heard some, you know, there's some funny stories, you know, and I think for some people, you know, when they hear, well, like, for example, the koan, you know, with the oak tree in the garden, please stand up, you know, and then, the gesture, you could say, is the person actually standing up, rather than pointing or, you know, crossing their eyes or something, they stand up.
Well, this gets tricky. You have to be awake. And I've done this with students of Sun Sun Im.
Sure.
The wonderful Korean Zen master, he's passed away now, but he said his whole teaching was only don't know, not knowing.
Right.
And this is fundamental to our teaching practice, is not knowing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is you ask the question, and you have to be able to, you have to be in that depth of receptivity, mm-hmm, to know whether or not the person is faking it or not.
Mm. Oh, so the teacher has to be
the teacher has,
yes,
to be awake.
Yes.
You know? Otherwise, it can be a mutual
Like a conspiracy, an egoic egoic conspiracy.
Codependency. Spiritual codependency. Right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So,
but there are three, there are three shifts in that begin with the philosophical deconstruction process of shifting your understanding. And the basic Buddhist teaching, from my perspective, begins with three fundamental, they're called the marks, or three statements, or three truths, or three realities, three views of reality that must be realized, not just understood, but truly stood under. And the first is impermanence. Nothing lasts. And the second is basic insufficiency, or dukkha, or pain. But in this case, it's sickness, old age, and death that brought that realization on. So inevitably, everything is going away. Everything is on fire. And from one point of view, everything is ultimately dissatisfactory. So these are, this is an understanding. So the first brings, and everything is inevitably painful. So the first brings the impermanence. If you really realize impermanence, brings gratitude. Oh, my God, this will never be again. Right? Everything is sacred. Everything is sacred. If you really grasp impermanence and see that truth. So shifting and understanding and getting the actual experience of the impermanent of all circumstances is primary. And the second is that pain, as in suffering, old age, and death, is inevitable. Mm. You don't have to run away from pain. Pain is the ego's trying to escape reality. So understand that, that pain is with pain is with life is pain. There's pleasure in pain. How wonderful. And to, you know, pain is part of your information system. And it's an exquisite gift to life, like pleasure, pleasure and pain. So you don't have to run or turn from pain. So your whole attitude can shift when you make that philosophical shift in your understanding. The only mistakes I ever made were running away from pain, primarily psychological pain. And then the third is wonderful. This is the big one. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Nobody. Now, the ego doesn't want to hear this. Yeah. The ego doesn't want to hear that it's a figment of imagination, divine imagination, temporary arising.
It's a little insulting.
Well, and this is where the magical thinkers come in, and the mythopoetic, and the subtle staters. And, you know, it's like, go shut up and go deep enough into your consciousness and recognize your true nature.
Yes.
Your true nature, the purity of your consciousness. Your ego, your self-referencing began. We could, if I could deconstruct you now psychotherapeutically down a timeline and just take you younger and younger. So you're 2 years old. How many words do you have? Okay, now you're a year old. How many words do you have? Hmm. Now you're 6 months. Now you're 3 months. Now you fall over on the floor. You can't get up. Now you can't control your bowels. And you can't say mama and dada, and there's no such thing as a dog, right? And if you keep going back, you'll discover there's no you. There's a pure receptive consciousness and awareness, and that reflective nature of egocentricity has a beginning. Right? And so it's like, whoa, well, isn't this interesting? If we deconstruct you down a timeline, you'll go to where there are no things, there are no external, internal references. There's simply an integrated oneness. And then you point out and go over there, and you reach back and you recognize here. And you begin the construct of an egocentric being. Mm. And then the egoist wants to take and have that continue. So the egoist immortalizes and attaches it to spirit, as opposed to a process or function, conscious reflectivity, the interplay of awareness inside a conscious vehicle. And claims that to be a self rather than a process. And actually claims that it's this is who I am, as opposed to this. These are the enormously interesting reactive patterns based on biophysical survival patterns, procreation drives, and confused parenting.
Yeah, I call it unresolved family of origin related issues.
Right. And when you get it, when you finally get it, that all you are is a story made up about reaction to sensing, which what I call God masturbating, right? If there were one,
sure.
She would be, you know. So in other words, that's the shift. That's a fundamental shift that is required in my language, if yes. you're going to step on the Buddha path. Otherwise, yeah. all you're doing is dragging your origin stories and everything, your mythopoetic magical thinking, and dragging it into this arena, and just, you know, you're moving deck chairs around in the Titanic.
Sure, sure.
Well, that's the shift in the foundational thinking that we had the argument first. Then we say, okay, now let's begin the koan deconstruction process, right. starting with the concentration practices. And then we say, okay, is it possible to purely listen? And once you establish the truth that there is this listening within you, and we use a bell and various other tricks, if you can't, good, to allow you to recognize it and get a taste. And it's an actual taste. It's an aha.
Mm.
It has to be a realization experience with an articulated understanding, an expression. If there's no articulated expression and understanding, there's no neurolinguistic access.
Mm-hmm.
So we deconstruct and then we reconstruct. So deconstruction by itself is only half the game. And then we say, okay, now where is the locus? Like right now, if you listen as deeply as you can, my brother, just drop everything. Just drop everything. Return to your deepest moment of meditation. Where is the bindu point within your corporeal, spiritual, body-mind complex? Is the listening in a deeper locus?
The heart.
So you go, it'd be great. You go right to the heart. 90%, 95% go right to the heart.
Yeah.
5%, the map makers and the theorists, they want to argue with you.
Sure.
But everybody goes, wow, it's right in the heart. Now, martial artists love the little lower in the belly. But you go, oh my God, if I'm truly listening, I'm in my heart. That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the difference? Then we get into really the feeling and the expression of that back and forth, back and forth. And then we pulse it by making a fist, and we use a slogan, I don't know versus not knowing. So we say, now, the question is, who are you at this depth of listening? And people will immediately tell you what they think or they feel.
Mm.
Emotionally based will give you their feeling, others will give you a thought. And we say, then you get them, you say, oh, gotcha. Now, has listening ever said anything? So we're deconstructing the view. If you're at this great depth center of listening in your heart, have you ever spoken? Oh, my God, this depth of awareness is silent? Well, where is the noise? Ego, surface, reflectivity. So we deconstruct that, get the experience of that, claim it, and then we make a fist with the hand. So use your ego and contract your psyche and feel how the mind contracts at the surface. Who are you? I don't know. Who are you? I don't know. And you say, okay, now drop the pronoun. Oh, my God, drop the pronoun? Okay, and just respond, not knowing. So then it's like, who are you? Not knowing. And the fist automatically opens, and the heart automatically opens, and the eyes sparkle. And then you point out, you know, this could be a little samadhi we have started here.
Sure.
So it's pointing that out. And then now we're finally getting nowhere. Okay, now we're getting nowhere.
Nowhere fast, right?
Nowhere fast. And so then the next question and the next koan is, okay, now what are we like at this depth? What are you like? What am I like? What are we like?
Mm.
And we're always first person subjective here and now, not it there. Anytime somebody says it there, they've pushed things off in second person or third person.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't have the experience.
So it's I am.
Right.
Yeah.
So we say, okay, so now, what are we like at this depth? At this depth we are, and we want specific signifiers. Right? So at this depth.
Yeah, pure
what
love.
Are we like?
Yeah, pure love.
Okay, now you would say pure love, and I would have to go, eh.
Nice.
Dive.
Nice.
Pure love arises.
Pure consciousness.
Okay, better. But when you said, and this is what everybody does,
yeah.
because they experience the love arising,
right.
and they want to say that that's it. But that's the realization of this depth of mind has compassion arising.
Uh-huh.
But this mind itself is the purity and fundamentally at the base, right? And so, and then, but you hit on it, we'd say, aware. And again, aware with an opinion or purely aware. Mm. And then people go, oh, purely aware. Mm. Okay, where's the opinion? Well, right here.
Sure.
But it's surface opinion. So we're deconstructing, having the experience, claiming the experience, and establishing then the series of signifiers that are access points. And I'll give you them quickly.
Yeah.
So are we time-bound at this depth of pure listening?
No.
No. Timeless.
Yeah.
Right? So we're timeless. Okay. Are we constricted in any way?
No.
No. Fast. So timeless. Are we noisy? Silent. And then we say, how silent? I like this one because it sets them up nicely. They'll say, yes, silent. I say, how silent? They'll go, oh, very silent. And I'll say, how about deathly silent?
How about shut up?
And their eyes roll around. No, I don't know about deathly silent. I say, well, you got to go a little deeper.
Oh, but my ego wants to live. I don't want to die. You mean I have to die?
I'm personally, this is the Zen saying, you need to die before you die so you can die properly. You know, I'm a stage 4 throat cancer survivor, and I'm turning 70 in the spring, and I'm pretty beat up from 4 months of chemo and radiation, and, you know, I'm looking forward to the exit. But I'm a little worried because what if I'm wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, that it's amazing, you know, that egoic voice, you know, it's like it's always making a racket, you know? I mean, it's
yep.
It's
well, here's what an ego does, right?
Yeah.
Me, 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 me,
yes.
Me,
yeah,
me,
yeah.
You, me, 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 you, me, me, me.
Yes.
And neurotic people go, me, 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 me.
Right.
And really cool people go, me.
Yeah, me. Yeah, big deal.
Me. Yeah. So it's like, you get it, that this ego is just a figment of divine imagination, is how I like to call it.
Yes.
So anyway, so now here's one that this is of critical importance. Ready?
Yeah.
How about afraid? Are you afraid at this depth? Is there anything that can turn you away if you're in this depth of clear, deep, hard mind listening? Is there anything you can't face?
No.
Great. So fearless. So at this depth of consciousness, you're fearless. Vast, timeless, fearless, open, peaceful, serene, aware, purely aware. Simply booed. So it's like, okay, so is this true? Right now, right here, right now, right here, inside the context of our dialogue. And once it's established that it is true, we say, oh, okay, great. Now, guess what we're going to do? We're going to take the words away. Because you got all these words that are our fingers pointing at the damn moon. Mm. Show me the moonlight. Show me. Show me. Show me with your eyes, show me with your spirit, show me with your body.
Mm.
But don't use any words. And then they struggle, and they have to make some kind of gesture. And I love the flaming heart gesture of Hanuman and Christ.
Mm.
That was my spontaneous, so I just ripped my chest open.
Oh, nice.
And I lean in and start laughing.
Right. Well, that explains the title, Heart Blown Open, you know, of the book.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so then we say, okay, now you've got it. And then once they do it, you say, okay, now let's give a name to this and do a call and response. So now they're calling to their higher self or their pure consciousness or their deep spirit or their Buddha or their soul or their Atma, whatever name you want to put on this consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly I can call to this and respond. So I can call and respond from here. So this process, learning process, goes on. We develop it. And then it's saying, okay, now, hey, can I talk to your controller?
Mm-hmm.
So we also have long conversations with the controlling part of the ego.
Yeah, sure.
The director of the ego. Once you recognize that your ego is being directed by you, right, and that you're clinging to all these ideas and everything, because you have to, because otherwise you'll be sitting in the corner drooling, right? You know, mm-hmm. The controller's job is to keep it all together, keep this myth going. So can you talk to your controller? Would you? You need more control. You've got a lousy job. No one explained the vastness and the opportunity in your job. Fearless, present, aware, timeless. Like, why would you? You want to add this stuff to your portfolio? Right? Would that be a great idea? And they, so we get into the argument there and reconstructing egocentric perspective, and then we say, okay, now what about your given name? How about from this day forward, your given name, the first thing you do is respond from clear, depart, mind as a discipline, right? And then, does this clear, depart, mind come and go? And they, at first people say, well, yes, it comes and goes all the time. Really? How can emptiness come and go? How can awareness and silence come and go?
Wrong.
Yeah. If there is sentience, if there is sentience, it has to be taking place in a Bood. Right? Whether you call that Bood a squirrel, a donkey, a grasshopper, or a human being. Mm-hmm. Consciousness, pure consciousness, has to be there for a sensing mechanism to take place. So wherever you are, if there's a sense of anything going on, it's because Buddha is present. But Buddha is silent. Mm-hmm. Right? So now you realize that no matter what the circumstances, you are fearless, present, timeless, aware, serene, and available, if you would like to be. Right? So that's the beginning deconstruction and reconstruction process. And then we go to, okay, now there are 13 questions.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gotten to say, okay, now there are two reasons that two necessary things that you need to do. First is, okay, how do you know this is real that we just went through? So again, this is a claiming process. You know it's real because you've had the experience. We're all in samadhi. We're working together. We're in intersubjective space. Everybody's getting high, and you keep pointing out the depth, the quality of the compassionate energy in the interaction and the purity of witnessing that's taking place. So you point that out as you move along. And then we say, okay, the reason is because you've had the experience. And this is Buddha, once again. Do not trust teachers. Do not trust teachings. Try them on. If it works and it's real for you, you know, take advantage. Otherwise, move on.
You know, one thing I've heard you say is that you'll awaken when you're willing to awaken. So like when you're willing to take your seat. And I was in Hawaii in December, and that was the message that came to me. Was I spent a lot of time just sort of sitting, and the message, it's time to take your seat at the table. And what do you mean by that? Because I imagine some people that come get it and some people don't.
That's the second question.
Yeah.
The second part of the 10th question is, okay, and what will be necessary for you to manifest this truth in your life that you can now claim?
Mm.
Right? You're going to have to choose it. This is death. This is ritual suicide. What it means is I have to interrupt my egocentric referencing and bring forward the deeper consciousness. So it's you choose. You choose this, and this not will happen. This will not happen until you choose this.
Mm-hmm. You said no one else can take your seat, or your seat will not be given to you.
Okay.
You
if
have to
I could
it.
Give it to you, I wouldn't give it to you. I wouldn't rob you of the joy of discovering it and taking it yourself.
Sure, and claiming it.
Yeah.
I mean, what encouragement would you give someone who was like, you know, whether in the process or not, who, you know, is aware of their true nature, but wanting to admit it, wanting to confess it?
Well, I'd say, deepen your meditation practice and then practice it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But again, the philosophical shift in the understanding of your truer and deeper nature. So it's not about nihilism. It's not about victimhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's about fiercely taking your seat and compassion and loving. And that's one of the reasons that people are unwilling to face life. It's because they're going to have to change their lives. It's like, oh my God, if I wake up and face things here, I'm going to have to change my life.
Right.
But so once the mission accomplished, we've accomplished that, then we go say, okay, now we've got the first part down, the insight on the deconstruction and the reconstruction of your perspective and philosophical view, a new neuro-linguistic in place. a practice and a process for you to be able to allow yourself to deconstruct yourself. Realization, okay, and is now available on demand by you stepping forward, because you've developed the skill set to do this through the Mondo process, the 10-koan process. And then we say, okay, now meditation, why bother? Now we get to the emotional body or emotional koans. And how are we doing for time here?
Well, we got about 10 minutes, and we got, you know, we've got a question for you, too. Are you up for a question?
Yeah, we have 10 minutes left for the whole thing.
Yeah, we've got about 10 to go.
I thought we were going to do another commercial break.
We skipped it. We're too good.
Yeah, we were having too much fun. I thought
let me speed this up a little bit then.
You bet.
We can come back to the question.
You bet.
So, okay, so once you've accomplished the deconstruction and you've developed a degree of insight that you can claim and bring forward volitionally, it isn't just going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now you can stop and drop. You can open your heart. You can open your eyes. You can lean in, because nothing can turn you away unless you choose to turn away. So then we say, okay, now, hey, the 11th koan is a trick question. Has anyone ever angered you? Has everyone ever made you angry? Or has anyone ever shamed you?
And is this an emotional koan? Because you talk about
this. Emotional koan.
Okay.
Now
yeah.
We go to emotional koans, where the rubber hits the road, right, where you can see this in your life. These are you'll put in place injunctions that transform your life. So the first question begins with a question. Has anyone ever shamed you or made you angry? And people go, all the time. And you go, okay, now let's get real clear about something. Okay, from this point of view, anger as violence projected into the world is not a feeling. Shame as violence projected towards yourself is not a feeling. It's a violent reaction to a feeling.
Mm.
And dissociation is a reaction to a feeling. What are you actually feeling?
Mm.
What is the feeling? Drop into the depth of the clarity, and what is the actual feeling? Not what is the reaction, which is now accepted. They say that anger is an acceptable emotion. It's a violent action, as it's normally understood. Anger is divine and delicious. You know, it's not violent. It's
right.
Incredible concern and intensity and presence and boundary.
Right, and clarity, too, I've heard you say.
You're right. Clarity of mind. So we change the philosophical construct of the understanding, the nature, intention, and function of feeling. Feeling is purely information. Feeling is information. Feeling is no different. This is classic Buddhist teaching. A feeling is a skanda. It's a function or an activity in a stable mind. So it's informing us. There's smell, there's touch, there's taste, and there's feeling, and there's thinking. How extraordinary. Gifts of consciousness. So what you're feeling is fear, and you're reacting to fear violently. You're projecting it out, projecting again, or disappearing. What you're feeling is fear, but you're also feeling something else. You're feeling a little sad because you're frightened. Something bad could happen here, and I don't want it to happen. So if you can get still enough and really watch this come up, right, you develop stability of mind. This is why you need thousands of hours, you need a certain amount, a definite period of mental discipline to developing concentration practices so you can stay present with whatever it is. You're not going off and fantasizing. You're staying fiercely present in your awareness training. And then you turn and you look at your life from that place, from a stable consciousness, rather than one that's hopelessly caught in reactivity. So when you get to the fear and you get to the sadness, you're halfway there. The reason I'm afraid and a little sad is because I deeply, deeply, deeply care.
Right.
So violence projected into the world externally as an intervention or internally against myself, right, is a confused reaction, right, to deep caring.
Mm.
So that's a huge shift. No one has ever made you angry.
And no one ever can they?
No one can.
Right.
You've reacted now. Well, it happens to me all the time, yes. But understand that it isn't you. And this is why we deconstruct the view, and this is why I do away with the doctrine of reincarnation. Because it perpetuates the mythology of a self. This isn't who you are. You're a pure consciousness with temporary reactive patterns. No one has ever made you angry. No one has ever shamed you. You know, this happened at such an early stage that you were unaware of it.
Right.
And you develop these habitual patterns. And that's who you temporarily are. but it's not a self that's going to be reborn or beat up or drug around or anything. You know, it's a the ego's a process.
Right.
So to see through that mythology. So once you've got that, now you're saying, oh, well, now can I talk to your controller again? Do you realize that no one has ever done this to you? No, your father didn't make you angry. No, your mother doesn't make you angry. Your wife doesn't make you angry. You make you angry.
Right.
They're just doing their stupid thing. And you're and you're caught hopelessly. There's a junkyard dog or, you know, beating yourself up or them up. And it's it becomes inconceivable. Anger is literally inconceivable. It's like jealousy. Mm. People say jealousy is, once if you're awake, you know, it becomes inconceivable to have these reactions. But right. Just developing a state stability won't do this.
Right.
You need to have the philosophical deconstruction, reconstruction, the neurolinguistic in place, so that when it happens, you're prepared for it. So then the second is, where in your life is someone making you angry?
Sure.
Is it when they cut off in traffic? It is when your wife comes home, and or the kids won't shut off the TV? What is it? And then you, well, they made me angry.
Right.
Well, that becomes your liberator. Your angst becomes your liberation.
Yes.
Once
yeah.
you're conscious, awakened, and disciplined, what used to frighten you and cause you to be violent or to shame yourself mm-hmm. or to disappear, now may you start laughing.
Yeah.
We've got a practice called sacred laughter. We've got a whole bunch of injunctions. But the idea is to get this shift in place so that now your life is this great adventure. It's like, come, and like in my tradition, we say, send me to hell quickly. I think I'm ready.
Right, right. Well, and that's it. That's the meaning of an awakened life. You know, I mean, that's the
right.
purpose of our discussion today. I mean, that's exactly it. Sure. Do you have any?
And I joke for a second, but what I'm saying is, and this is what's been inside the classical traditions for 2,500 years. Gautama was the first non-dual yogi to teach non-atma or selflessness successfully. They took it and immediately turned it all back into the myth, into the ethnocentric mythopoetic interpretations and translations. But the teaching is still fundamentally pure there. If you go really take it apart and study it, this is where you'll end up. Excuse me.
Thank you. No, thank you. So do you have any retreats coming up or anything, Jimpo, that people might could know about?
Yeah, you go to mandazen.org. Yeah. I've got, and my next retreat is in Holland.
Oh, okay.
That's the end of February. I just finished one in California. Then I've got one coming up in April in Philadelphia, May in Colorado,
okay,
July in Utah. Yeah.
And these details are on the website, right?
Yeah, mandazen.org.
And also, I just want to give people another heads up about this book, A Heart Blown Open, Your Life Story, which is... well, it's more than that, but it's coming out on February 1st. And I just, some accolades, Ken Wilber said, this is the story of our time, an absolute must read for anyone with even a passing interest in human evolution. And then Alex Gray, who's one of my, I mean, I feel like I'm looking at his stuff every day. He said, this is the legendary story of an aspiring teacher that mirrors the journey of many contemporary Western seekers. So,
Alex Gray and I, we're teaching this year at ISE, Integral Spiritual Experience, out in, over the New Year's, out in California.
Yes, yeah.
And I finally met him. I've been in love with his work. And he and I actually met in the old days through my shamanic medium.
Oh, wow. Okay. Got it. Well, he's I mean, just like you, he's a beloved bodhisattva. And Jinpo, I just can't thank you enough for taking the time today. It's been, I mean, I've been looking at your stuff for a while, but it's been enlightening.
But when is your ask, excuse me, did I say a bad word?
When
is your DEA going to be parked at one of our retreats?
Yeah, well, I think that could be arranged. I'd love to.
Please do come. It'd be wonderful to have you. And you know, you'll pick up some skills.
Well, I appreciate it. Do you have a message to our listeners as we kind of close out today? Personal message?
Yeah, get serious about your practice. Don't wait to awaken. I mean, there's so much pain in the world. So it's our job to wake up, grow up, and show up, you know? So come out of the myth of your own being. Come back to, you know, compassion. We have five training elements. The first is environmental stewardship, sacred stewardship. What's in your refrigerator? What are you doing to the world? What are you doing to each other? What are we doing to each other, my brother? What are we doing? What about love? What about caring and consciousness? Yeah. So wake up, you guys.
Thank you, Jimpo.
Help us all wake up. Help us all wake up.
Thanks for leading the way, Jimpo. Much appreciated.
Thank you, my brother. I had a great call. I'm inspired now. I'm going to go meditate.
Hey, everyone, you're listening to Transformation Talk Radio. Don't touch that dial. We'll be beginning a brand new show at the top of the hour with one of our amazing hosts, Transformation Talk Radio. Talk radio to change the world. Listening to Transformation Talk Radio. Our hosts are setting a new standard for a fresh kind of talk radio, creating conversations that are transforming the world, one listener at a time. Transformation Talk Radio's mission is to broadcast a distinct blend of live talk radio interviews with a mix of uplifting and intelligent news, educational and practical information. Topics range from personal development to critical issues relevant to a rapidly changing world. Stay tuned. Transformation Talk Radio starts at the top of every hour.